Welcome to All Been Inside, a podcast series produced by Voices for Change. Voices for Change is a self-advocate group from Melbourne, Australia.
Using our lived experience, expertise, we help organisations work for making life better for people with an ABI.
We also educate the community about ABI and try to address the stigmas we carry about our lived experience.
Just a heads up, from now on, you may hear us talk about acquired brain injury as an ABI, so don't forget it, okay?
We talk about issues like intimate partner violence, alcohol and other drugs, and the way the justice system could improve things for people with an acquired brain injury.
We want you to take care when you listen to our stories and reach out for help if you need it. We will let you know where you can get it.
We have created this series to be uplifting. We want to show that it is possible to overcome the challenges in your life.
We want it to be thought-provoking, which means we want it to catch you and motivate our policy makers to create changes we need.
We hope you enjoy our series and that you learn something about our community.
For more information about our work, follow the link to our website and our social pages.
My name's Michael Main, and I am a person that has an ABI, and I have done a lot of time in prison, and I'm here to try and make it a lot more accessible for people that have got an ABI and have been going through the justice system, prison. I'm a pretty easygoing guy. Like to laugh and joke around a lot, and you know, sometimes, but I also know when I've got to be serious, like now. But I like to, joke around, I'm funny, and just like to make sure everything goes smooth and no hassles. I've had enough of the hassles in my life over the years, so I just like to try and make my life and everybody else's life around me as comfortable and easy as can be. Well, early years at school, I was never any good at school, so I was always getting, because I couldn't read or write when I was younger, so I was the person that mucked up in class where I'd get sent to the principal's office, so I didn't have to be embarrassed about not being able to read or write. And from then on in my life, just went, dragged my way through primary school until I got to high school, and I got into about year nine, I think it was, form three, I think that is, and then I got asked to leave high school, and from then I had a motorbike, and one of the reasons I got asked to leave is because I was riding my motorbike through the school, which you're not allowed to do. And, just from then on, I just slowly progressed. Because I was the youngest of seven kids, and I didn't sort of hang around my family members. They were a bit older than me. So I made up my own group of friends in the neighbourhood where I lived, and eventually grew into a young man that was always getting in trouble with my motorbikes on the road and getting chased by the police. And, and eventually I started stealing cars. You know, I was hanging around people that were older, a little few years older than me, so, and I was just probably just trying to fit in with what they were doing. And from a young age, I was a bit of a tea leaf. I'd steal things, cars and motorbikes, and go out and rob factories and make my money. We weren't a rich family, so whatever I got, I virtually stole and got myself, because my mum and dad didn't have much money. We were, like middle-class family. Didn't have lots of riches. So, yeah, I made my own way and then grew into a criminal. And then I was been in boys' homes from the age of about 13, 14, just for small stuff, riding a motorbike on the road, and, you know, eventually grew into, I'd say, bigger thing. I wouldn't say better, but bigger crimes and all that sort of stuff. And then I hit Pentridge because I escaped from Malmesbury boys' home. And from then I just didn't really look back. My crimes got bigger along the way. And, I just become out of control. And when my parents died, in both in 88, 2 months apart from each other, I was 18 and I just didn't care about myself, let alone anybody else. So I did what I had to do to survive. You know, I didn't have my family to say, oh, here's some money or here's this. You know, I never had parents after that. So I just, yeah, my friends were like my older friends were like my parents and my family. So I just grew to love them. And eventually, as I said, I went to Pentridge Prison, and it was like going from one suburb to another, from, say, Flemington to Coburg, and I'd see other family members there, cousins and uncles and all that sort of stuff, and they sort of took me in under their wing, which was, looking at it now, was probably the wrong thing to do. They should have just given me a good swift kick up the backside and say, what are you doing here? But, yeah, they looked after me because I was a younger member of the family, and I just in and out of jail most of my life. When you talk to me about rehabilitation in prison, it's bull. There's no such thing as rehabilitation. All it is just keep you there till your time's up and they let you out. Like, there's schooling you can do there, which I did. I'd done my hospitality and all that there. Got my cert free in hospitality. I was always working in every kitchen, every jail I went to. Rehabilitation. If anybody that says to me about rehabilitation in jail, I disagree, because there was never no rehabilitation. From 2017, I haven't been back in prison. And I've been doing this Voices for Change ever since, and it's changed my life. It's got me out of the gutter, so to speak. You know, I've got a roof over my head, I've got a partner, I've got money, I've got everything that I need, you know. Sometimes I haven't got money, but I'm alive. As I said, being on drugs and that at a younger age, I've overdosed a couple of times, and that's how part of the reason why I have an ABI and the motorcycle smash that I had when I was younger. Yeah, so you had enough. When you've had enough of jail, you've had enough. And the things that matter to me now is, you know, my family that I have left, my group that I'm involved with, Voices for Change, and my church. When I was down at Marguerite Prison, I think it was around 2010 or something, I was down there doing a high violence course. And to get your parole and all that back then, you had to do, you know, many courses. And I had a counsellor down there, counsellor, and a therapist, sorry, that's what they were called. And I spoke to them about it down there, about my accident I had, and they mentioned it, but it was only just, we only spoke about it for a couple of weeks because I'd seen them once a week. And they said, oh, maybe you got an ABI. And I didn't know what it was back then. I didn't remember the next day what we were talking about. And then I've seen the doctor that I'm with now, Sybil. She's really good, and she said, I want to do a few tests and that with you to see if you have an ABI. And then she sent me off to see some specialist, and it turns out that I have got an ABI. . 2% of Australians have an ABI, but in Victorian prisons that number is far higher. A study by Corrections Victoria found that 42% of male prisoners and 33% of female prisoners have an ABI. However, studies suggest that percentages of prisoners with an ABI could actually be much higher, even up to 90%. Yeah, well, I was about 47 years old when, roughly, when we found out that it was confirmed that I had an ABI. you know, I'm hoping, you know, they can work out that people that have got ABIs, they can work, come up with a system or a way to keep people out of prison, because, let's face it, prison's, it's just a sad, lonely place, prison, you know, like, people that are in prison that have an ABI or mental health issues, I've seen firsthand, because I was up at a desk one day asking the officers for something, and another guy had been up there asking him for something, and you could see that he had an ABI or mental health issues. And the way they spoke about him when he's walked away, when his back was turned, was, I said something to him. I said, do you think you'd be saying that to his face if he was still here? And they looked at me as if to say, oh, what would you know, blah, 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 you know, who are you, you know? So, yeah, they do treat people that have an ABI or mental health issues a lot different to someone that can know what's going on and would stand up for themselves straight away. Because just the way they spoke to this guy, he walked around, he walked off like it was a joke, you know what I mean? But I would have been, if it had been me, I would have been still there arguing the point with him today, because I can't remember exactly what they said, but they were joking at his expense, and that's not a nice thing to do. According to Australia's Institute of Health and Welfare, as of 2022 in Australia, 39% of people entering prison said they had a disability that affected their daily lives. 25% of people in the prison may have borderline intellectual disability. 10% of people in prison may have a mild intellectual disability. And 51% of people entering prison had a diagnosed mental health condition at some point in their lives. Well, when the doctor told me that I had an ABI, I didn't know what to think, like, because I didn't know what an ABI was. Yeah, like, it was hard for me to wrap my head around. Like I said, I didn't know what it was, and then we sat down and the doctor explained to me what it was like to have an ABI, what I'm sort of like, what she can understand is what I'm going through and how hard it is to sort of like, I suppose, my way of putting it is like, fit in with normal society. You know, I felt like I'm on the back foot, and you know, people that haven't got an ABI, they're a lot smarter than me. Because I used to think, well, why am I always getting in trouble and all that over the years? And why have I spent my life in and out of jail? Because in my whole family, I'm the only one that's got an ABI, and I'm the only one that keeps on going in and out of prison. And I didn't really know what to feel or expect. But she said, you know, there's things you can do. You go and see specialists and all that sort of stuff. ABI, in my understanding, is an ABI that has difficulties with, could be a range of things, with speech, with learning, with the capabilities of what the normal person that doesn't have an ABI, they see things different, you know, like they see things like as a, obviously it's a disability, but it's hard to explain, but I find it's, having an ABI is, I feel like I know I'm not, but I feel like a second-class citizen because I don't understand, you know, a lot of things. Like I could never read it. When I was at primary school, I couldn't read or write. I taught myself in jail how to read or write by reading the newspaper. And all those times going to prison, if I had been screened, if there was some way they could have screened me to see if I had an ABI, I think my time in prison maybe would have been shorter. Times in prison and a lot different, because as I said, and I'll say it a million times, there was no screening for ABIs or mental health issues, and unless you come in and you know you obviously look like you had mental health issues, that's the only time they'd look at you, because other than that you're just another box. They tick the numbers and pass it on that they've done their job. But yeah, they certainly do need to be able to screen people that who have, to find out if they have an ABI or mental health issues, because it's not done. Yeah, and in saying that, if there was the opportunity back then to get some information about an ABI or anything like that, I would have made different decisions in my life, and maybe I wouldn't have been in and out of prison, because it would have made things a lot easier for me to be able to understand. right, about 5 years ago, five and a bit years ago, a friend of mine, Arthur, rang me up and said, you're up for doing a course. They're going to pay you $100 a week for going and doing it. And I, at the time, I thought, $100. I was just living in Richmond, you know, it was close to going to, into Ross House where we did the course, started the course. And $100 is $100, you know, but over the time of doing it, I've become to enjoy going there. I look forward to going there. And you know, I was learning about ABIs and mental health issues. And I could have fun there too, you know. It wasn't just all serious, like education stuff. You're going to school and you got to, you know. So it was really good. And now I love the place. You know, it's grown to be like my second family. And what I do for Voices for Change, it's helping people. And that's, I can't pay back what I've done, all the wrongs I've done in my life. And this is one way where I know I'm helping someone that's got an ABI or mental health issues. I'm doing good. You know, I'm not doing bad. What we're doing, there's not another group in Victoria like it. And we want to make more of them. We're motivational speakers for people that have been in prison. We speak up on their behalf and we go to different places in the community and we talk to people about people that have an ABI that have been through the justice system. And we give them the knowledge to understand what it's like and how hard it is for people that have got an ABI, and just to make everybody aware. So awareness makes things grow, and I want to make our group, Voices for Change, grow into something big. Yeah, you can learn a lot from research, but I reckon it's better if you learn a lot from someone like myself that has an ABI. My first question to you, Stan, is can you please introduce yourself and give some background of your experience advocating for people with an ABI?
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, my name's Stan Winford. I'm Associate Director at the Centre for Innovative Justice, which is at RMIT University. And in that role at RMIT, I've done quite a bit of research, but probably the reason I ended up doing that was because of my early career as a lawyer working at Fitzroy Legal Service, where I was a criminal defence advocate appearing in court for people, many of whom had disabilities, including cognitive impairments like acquired brain injuries. And I suppose when you do that sort of work, you realise how common those issues are for people, but also how there are a lot of failings and shortcomings in how the criminal justice system responds to people with disability. And I have to admit, my own understanding of disability and its impacts was also pretty poor. And I suppose I was just like everyone else in that system. I didn't really understand it very well. But after a few other jobs, I ended up helping establish the Centre for Innovative Justice in about 2012. I thought it was really important to sort of work a bit more closely with people who are, in my view, closest to the problems and probably have a better idea of what will work for them. And so I was lucky enough to be able to get a decent grant of funding through the Office of the Public Advocate. And with that funding, we proposed a project that would form a group of people who had brain injuries, who'd been through the justice system, and speak with them and work with them on what the issues were that they faced and how they could best be addressed. And we learnt from them about, I guess, every stage of the criminal justice system and how it doesn't work, and also what some ideas for change were. And following that important piece of work, some really great things have come out of that. And, you know, you'll recall we did the training, the Voices for Justice training, and that's really been part of what's led to, you know, Voices for Change and that sort of stuff, which is really important because there hadn't been before then any groups with people with lived experience that were speaking back to the justice system about what needed to change. I think it's one of those things where even after 12 years or more of doing that work, there's still so much more to be done. But for me, it seems pretty clear that there's just a much greater awareness of the issue and people are actually starting to try to do something about it and recognising that it's more of an issue than, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Okay, thank you, Stan. My next question, what is the most important thing that you have learnt about ABIs through your work?
I've learnt lots of things, but some of the most striking things, I think, for me were how common and how prevalent they are, particularly for people who've been in the justice system. So, I mean, the shocking statistic that really spurred us to do the Enabling Justice Project was that 42% of male prisoners and 33% of female prisoners in Victorian prisons had an acquired brain injury, compared with between 2 and 3% of the general population. That was just astounding and shocking. And it said, you know, to me that something's not right, something's not working, and something needs to be done about it. The other thing that once I sort of got into it a bit more that I found quite amazing is probably just realising that not everyone who has an acquired brain injury actually realises they do. And a lot of the time in the justice system, people say, oh, well, you know, if you've got an ABI, we'll do this or that, we'll give you these services or respond in various ways. But actually, the system pretty much relies on people to identify themselves as having an ABI to get help. And that doesn't work for several reasons. One is because people don't always know that they have an ABI. And secondly, because even if they do know, they might not be willing to disclose it, because disclosing an ABI in prison or even to police can actually be harmful, because they don't use it to help you, they use it against you. So police will lean on you to get you to admit to doing something that you may not have done. And in prison, people might stand over you, or, you know, it just doesn't lead to good outcomes. It actually can lead to more vulnerability or exploitation. So relying on people who may not know they have an ABI, or who may know that they do have an ABI but might be too scared to tell anyone, is not a good way to respond to ABIs in the system. The other thing, which I think I know you're pretty interested in, is that there's no really systematic check that happens for people with acquired brain injury when they come into the prison system. There is no screening tool that's used. So people just keep coming into the system and not having their ABI recognised. And like in that Enabling Justice Project, we spoke to a lot of people that had been in and out of the system many, many times, and it wasn't until, you know, their 10th or 12th time that anyone picked up on it. And to get that formally assessed is quite a costly process, and a lot of people don't have access to those reports and so on. So that's one thing. And then even if they do get those reports done, well, they get lost. So they don't travel with people through the system. So you might go in there after your 12th time and finally someone works it out and you get a report, and then you come out again, and then you might go back in again, but it won't be registered anywhere and no one will have that report. And I think the people often say, oh, let's do better at identification of people with ABI, and I think that's important, but not if it doesn't relate to actually better outcomes and responses. And often in the system, you might even identify, say, that someone has a particular impairment, but nothing's done about it anyway. I was really interested to read, there was a report by the Victorian Auditor General. So it's like someone in the government or independent of the government, who makes sure that the government's doing the right thing with spending money and whether the programs are working, all that kind of stuff. And they actually did a report in 2023 that examined closely how prisons were responding to disability, and did say prisons don't have a proper screening and assessment tool. And also that although the Prison Disability Service Initiative was a good idea, that it was underfunded, and actually when they applied for more money in the budget, they didn't get the money to expand it. So clearly there's a need for a lot more resources in prisons to support people with ABI. I suppose the other thing that's happened that's probably a positive thing is the advent of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So although there are some real problems with people getting access to the NDIS when they're in the criminal justice system, and that often means that when they come out of the prison, they're not connected with the NDIS, at least there is a kind of area where there is more resources available to people with moderate to severe ABIs.
Why do you think a lot of people with ABIs end up in prison in the first place? How could we prevent this?
I like to think about these sort of problems by thinking about how someone travels through a justice system. So, and even, you know, you could go back further to their lives and, you know, whether they grew up with good families or good support or not, whether they're exposed to family violence, whether they were exposed to, you know, drugs and things like that. Those are all factors that contribute to people having contact with the justice system, because obviously certain types of people in the community get over-policed and targeted and so on, and they have less access to what I'd call diversion programs. So, you know, alternative approaches when people have contact with police. If you're, you know, if you're from a privileged background, you probably get a caution or a diversion. But if you come from the flats or, you know, you're an Aboriginal person, you're much less likely to get those opportunities to stay out of the system. And as you know, once you're in the system, particularly as a young person, and the longer you're in the system, the more likely you are to be stuck in there. You know, it's like a quicksand. It keeps you trapped. And so those are kind of at the beginning of the process. Then I suppose even if you think about when you come into contact with the police and you're getting interviewed about whether you've done a crime, there should be better support for people. And there is a program called the Independent Third Person Program. But when you talk to people who've been picked up by the police, often they haven't been able to access that program. And so, again, they get perhaps, you know, involuntarily they make admissions and get charged. And then when that happens, no one's there to kind of help them navigate through getting to court and making sure they've got reports about their disability and so on that would help get a better outcome in court. That's an issue. Access to lawyers and legal representation is an issue. Access for the lawyers to funding to get reports is an issue. When you come to court, there aren't that many good options for people with disability. So there should be more options for judges and magistrates to give people that focus on their disability support needs rather than just punishment. And then, as we've talked about, if that person's unlucky enough to get sentenced to a jail term, they come in to the system and no one picks up that they've got the acquired brain injury. If they're lucky enough to have that picked up, there aren't many programs in prison for people with disability. So corrections has only adapted or modified a couple of programs for people, rehabilitation programs for people. So most people with disability can't access the programs that help people rehabilitate and help them get parole. The way the system works also means that people don't know when they're going to be eligible for parole. So it's really hard to line up a program when it's not clear when you're going to get released. Then if you get released, have you been connected with support? Have you had NDIS accessed in prison? Have you got housing? Most of the time, that's not the case for people, and a lack of housing particularly and a lack of disability support can make it really hard for people to survive. Even with non-prison options like community corrections orders, there isn't a lot of help for people. So these days, the laws mean that anyone who breaches the conditions of an order is much more likely to get punished for it. Used to be able to get a bit of leeway, you know, if you missed an appointment, that sort of stuff. These days, a lot of people get breached on those orders, and that's what sends them back to prison. And I think that's a really big issue. So I would think that in an ideal world, the community corrections orders would have people that supported people to get through their orders rather than sat back and looked out for breaches and seeing them off to court. So, yeah, you can see that every step of the way along that journey that someone might go through, there's missed opportunities for them to get the right support at the right time. And even, you know, if they go through a few times, that even if a court, you know, says this person's got a ABI and gets a report, you know, it doesn't stay with them. And just one other thing I'd add on that is that in some circumstances, for example, if you're a young person and you don't have an independent person with you, they can't use that interview. So it would be pretty simple to change the law to say that if police don't ensure that you have access to an independent third person, that interview can't be used in court. Now, they're not going to do that until, well, one of the reasons they might not do that is because those programs are not resourced enough to ensure that everyone who with a disability gets pulled up by the police and interviewed can access. So if there was better access to that independent third person program, and if it was the law that if that support wasn't there for you, the police couldn't use your interview, that would be much better.
How do you think our system could do a better job supporting people with an ABIs in prison?
Well, I think people in prison need programs that are accessible to them. So, you know, a lot of the programs are designed for people that don't have brain injuries or other forms of cognitive impairment. So they're just not, they just don't work for people. And often they're not available in all prisons. Another thing would be that prison officers have better awareness and training about disability. And the project that I mentioned before, we did a bit of work on that, but it's not compulsory. So the prison officers who are interested will do it, but those who are not interested, who might be the problem, they don't do it. And then I suppose the really critical part is transition. So when you get parole, what support do you have to find housing, to stay in touch with disability supports and the like? And that's a real problem. There's just this, I guess it's like they use the word silo, where what happens in prison is kind of not connected to what happens outside prison, even though making that journey successfully requires a lot more connection and coordination. And sometimes it's because the release dates are really uncertain for people, but often it's more because there isn't enough resources for programs to support people exiting prison.
Yeah, well, I find that there are ways of doing things. I mean, one, I feel that people like myself and other people with ABIs should be involved with some of these correction talks and with everybody, because, as you know, the old saying, there's nothing about us without us. Well, it's true, because we've been there. We know what needs to be done. We're not superheroes. We're not going to come in and change the system overnight, but people from corrections and through the courts and everybody involved, lawyers, they all need to sit down with people like myself and other members, because we know we know what fails, what doesn't fail. You know, we know, like, there's a lot that we can do. What it is, I feel it's the trust issue between the government and the ex-prisoner. Once we can break that barrier down, I feel that things will change.
Thanks, Michael. Can I just ask you something that you mentioned? Like, I agree with everything you've said, but interested to know, like you were saying, that there's a problem with trust in terms of government or people in positions of power or influence to change things, whether they trust people with lived experience to talk to them. What's going on there, and do you think there's something that could be done about that?
Yeah, well, I feel that the government needs to trust people like myself. Like, I've been out of jail for probably 8-9 years now. The government needs to listen to people like myself and other members of my team from Voices for Change and you guys, you know, CIJ. The government needs to listen to what we have to say, because we only want to do the right thing. After me doing the wrong thing all my life, my purpose and goal, my goals before I leave this world is to do good. And to do good, this is what I can do. This is the only way I can pay back, Stan. So,
and it doesn't help anyone to keep stigmatising people or keeping them in that position of not being able to participate in what's going on, or not to bring their expertise to problems and so on. So that is a real problem. And the other thing is, like, it's not working, because people who've been to jail come back within 2 years, 40-50% of them, depending on what stats you look at. So that's not what it's been set up for. It's supposed to help people change their behaviour, come out of there and not go back. So it's a real problem we've got, which is just not letting people get past their past.
All right, Stan, thank you very much for your time today, mate. It's been, once again, it's been a pleasure sitting here with you.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, and I think the work that you do and Voices for Change does is just fantastic, and I'm really grateful for what you do to help people better understand how things need to change and what could be done better. And anything that we can do to promote that, obviously we're right behind you.
No worries. The Independent Third Person Program is a volunteer service. It helps people living with disabilities when they are being interviewed by police. This makes sure they are not disadvantaged during the process. The Office of Public Advocates runs the program. However, the program is currently underfunded. The Victorian Government should change the Crimes Act. There should be a requirement to have the independent third person available when police interview a person with cognitive impairment or mental health issues. The Victorian Government should properly resource and professionalise independent third person program. The program should support people with disability from the first contact with the police all the way through to the courts or the tribunal processes. The program should also refer people to services and support agencies. I'm a movie star, I'm not a screenwriter, a talker, you know what I mean?